Are you implying that in the church we should also have the numbers of converts and disciple makers decided within the session or deacon board or something?
No, I'm not saying that, because I don't know what you should do. All I can say is that I do know for the navigators. I don't know for the church. But I do know that the objective is disciples, converts, disciples, and disciple makers and leaders. And however you and the leaders of your church decide to measure that, you'd have to work that out. It might be quite a long time before you ever got them to agree on quantitative goals. So I really... But whatever it takes, I'd sure move in the direction of at least evaluating what has actually happened. And I think that we learn, too, that goals are really yardsticks. They're that by which we can measure progress. And we may exceed or go under, but it's like a financial report. It doesn't so much tell you anything as give you a basis on which to ask questions. And that's why I think that some specific goals... Then when the year goes by, you take a look at it and say, now how did we do? It isn't so important whether you exceeded or under or just hit it, but you knew the direction you were going, and it gives you the basis on which to ask questions. Maybe we set the goal too high. Maybe we set the wrong goal. But it gives you a basis then, I think, to make progress. But I think you've got to have your people with you, and that may take a year, a couple of years, to get them with you before you could really move into that. That would be my thought. So I don't know. Others may. Maybe somebody does that. Maybe does anybody have quantitative goals set for your church? Do you? And how do you find that's working?
Well, it's just in my own mind. I haven't... I just shared it with our board of deacons and told them this is a goal that I've set for myself. Hope they'd pray and help me reach that goal.
I think that's a good point, too. Like Jesus said, I have many things to say to you, but you cannot bear them yet. And so you may have them in your own mind for a while. I think we all ought to have our own goals in our mind, have our dream, if you want to call it that. Then you can share it with a few of your inside people. And
well, this was on winning people to Christ. Now, we've set goals for... our mission giving, increasing it 5% each year until we at least get 50-50, and we're at 40% now. And a lot of other little things that the church has actually voted on to do, but winning people to Christ was a personal goal,
yes,
that I had set.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yes?
I just thought of some questions that relate to that, that maybe might move us in this direction. We could ask our man, what has happened that's good? And how did it happen? Can we help it happen again? How? And how can we help it happen more frequently? Maybe that would be something in the direction, and then later on we can talk about numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Another question or observation you'd like to make on anything that you've covered in your group or that we covered earlier? Yes?
You mentioned going to a group with your plan, at least here, if not written down, to give everybody a copy of it, and leaving with a better plan. It isn't always a better plan when you share it with... You know what I'm getting to?
Well,
a lot of people might not share the same objectives at all, and the plan would be far less than what you have.
Well, then, if I were in that case, I would accept their plan, and I'd come back with my plan a year later. Because there's no hope to get my plan accomplished without their participation. So I feel I'm far better off than when I walked in, even though the goals are half as much as I had hoped for. You've got to have, as I see it, the enthusiastic participation of the people that are going to help carry out the plan. And I know whether it's my work or when I was with the Billy Graham team or whatever, you go as far as you can. Now, after you get going on that for a few years, then I think you develop a core of, a hardcore, an inner core of leaders that will improve on your plan. And then they'll begin to set goals higher than you would. You maybe have to trim them back. But But I'd be satisfied. I'd be satisfied. At least we've got a plan. Then next year, we can have that to evaluate by, and then we can proceed and say, well, man, that was all right. We did that, didn't we? Oh, we can do better next year. But what I'm trying to say, too, is that not to dump my plan on them. I don't tell them what the plan is. You're, of course, all aware that that goes over like a lead balloon. You know, it's already cut and dried. And if there's no response, I'd wait. Put it aside and wait. Pray about it and wait. And the navigators, and we have the advantage of having a picked staff and all that goes along with this. But still, if there's somebody in that group that's got a big hang-up on that, we just wait and pray about it. Until we either have a unanimity on it, or he feels that even though he still doesn't understand it, he has now, since everybody else is strong enough, he's willing to go along with it. In other words, but there has to be unanimity. That's the means to wait. And I believe in just being open with folks, you know, and trust them. I remember one time I was, we used to have servicemen centers in Europe, and we had one in Wiesbaden. So when I went over, we had luncheon to the chaplains. So I said to the chaplain, should we open it or close it? Well, our local representative who was managing it just went absolutely purple. And I said, look, you don't lose that way. And suppose they said close it. We didn't want to. We'd say, well, appreciate your thought, but I think we still only have peace to close it, at least right now. We'll go ahead, but thanks for your help. I mean, you don't have to. But there's something about you give people the key to your heart, they'll give you the key to theirs. I think that's involved in planning with your people. It seems to me, if I could suggest something here, every organization has, there's two organizations. There's the chart, the formal one that you set up. You know how that is. And then there's the other one that's the real one. Whether that's the navigators or a church or a Billy Graham team or General Motors or anywhere, I'll guarantee you there are two organizations. And especially true, I think, more in volunteer groups. And in order to tell the real organization, just watch who goes to who for what. That's your real organization. You may say that Joe Blow over here is responsible for the couples. And that's what it says on the chart, and that's what somebody voted him in. But you notice that people actually go over to Gus Klimfuss over here. And this may be your formal organization, but the real one is there. And, of course, our problem is trying to get the real one and the formal one to mesh. Isn't that right? So it seems to me that you have to live two lives. You've got the formal one, and you've got some deacons here, or whoever your top men in your church are, and you've got to get with them. You need to pray with them individually because you need their backing in what you're going to do. At the same time, your spiritual strength may be elsewhere, or a good hunk of it. And so you need to give some time there, too. And maybe this guy, Gus Klimfuss, here, or his brother, Joe Klimfuss, and you've got to work that out. But this may be where the spiritual work is getting done. And my observation is that we'll be talking about training spiritually qualified leadership. And if you do that on an individual basis, you really have to lead two lives. And you talk publicly about this one, and you do this other one privately, and the less you say about it, the better off you are. But do I communicate that? And if I do, do you agree with me there? Chapter and verse. Well, I can give you experience more than chapter and verse. I've met pastors here and there, whether it's Australia, New Zealand, Dallas, Texas. I went down to the Bill Gothard Basic Youth Conflict Institute. Incidentally, have you ever gone to that? Never heard of it? Man, my wife and two daughters and I went to that this spring. The most profitable week we've ever spent as a family in our lifetime. And that's, I've been with women in quite a few places. But there I met a guy in the bathroom.
He says, look to me, he said,
Lawrence Sandy, don't I know that name from somewhere? Well, I said, Colorado Springs? Yeah, yeah. Navigate. Hey, you know what he said I'm doing? He said, I'm trying to use the Navigator principles to train some leadership in my church. And I'm meeting with some individuals 6:30 every morning. One morning 6:30, one man, next morning 6:30, we talked about that a little bit. And I made the remark, I said, you know, you mustn't say too much about that, right? He said, right. Because people get upset when you begin to look like you're playing favorites with somebody. This is what I mean by you live sort of a double life. Because, that's a whole story. I have a little talk I sometimes give on Tom, Dick, and Harry. Who should you spend your time with? Tom's a new convert. Dick is Mr. Fine Christian who has no real problems and doesn't do much either, but there he is. He's there all the time, but that's about it. And then there's Harry, who's your Sunday school superintendent. If you can only give time to one of them, who do you spend your time with? And that's another subject, but that's what we're talking about. I'll tell you who I would. I'd start with the Sunday school superintendent, whether I liked it or not. Because I've got to have his cooperation. And he may not be as the same potential as Tom, but I have to start where I am, not where I wish I were. That's just a good principle in any time, isn't it? And anyway, I got off track here. Okay, what else? Somebody else had something. Way back there, yes.
I don't know if this is outstanding. We talked about farmers, and you know, farmers are not outstanding in this field.
Yeah.
We talked about Acts 6 when you mentioned the matter of Stephen and explaining people to care for the widows. And we spent our time talking about how in the world do you get people to become responsible, people to whom you can delegate authority if they just won't accept it. We'd appreciate your comments on that.
One time with the Graham team, and this is all too typical, among other things in our organizational structure, we needed somebody to be responsible for the counseling room or the counseling tent. So the counseling and follow-up committee recommended a guy, so I phoned him and he came in to see me and he said, would you write me a job description and send it to me and I'll consider it. Well, I thought, I'd never written up a job description for, seeing the lights are on, chairs dusted, windows open, materials put out, and the unused one gathered up again. So, all right, I'll do that. So I sent him a letter with the job description, and I forget what it was, but I thought of a sixth item. I included that. He came back in a few days later with this letter in hand, and he said, as I recall, we talked the other day, we agreed that I would do A, B, C, D, and E. Now, I will do A, B, C, D, and E. And you will get someone else to do F, won't you? I said, yes, I'll get somebody else to do F. Well, we struck up a friendship. I began to meet with him, and I got him started in a quiet time. 15 minutes a day. And also got him to start memorizing scripture. And through the years, I felt that if I can only get a person to do two things, out of all the dozens of things there are, those are the two things I'd concentrate on. A daily quiet time and to commit choice scriptures to memory. Do you know, inside of about 3 weeks, this fellow, after he got started in his quiet time and memorizing scripture, he was not only doing A, B, C, D, and E, but he was doing F, G, H, I, J, K, and he was constantly in noon times after work wondering what else it was that he could do. I don't know any other way to get people to work for Christ than first to pray the Lord of the harvest that he'll send forth laborers, and secondly, to deepen their spiritual walk with the Lord so that it begins to well up from within. And this is why the navigators were nuts on an idea. It's that somewhere, some way, to get the kind of people we're talking about, that I'm almost ready to say there's no other way. It's not that cut and dried. But personal, individual attention. It has to be personal and individual. You might ask me, what's the difference on that? There's quite a bit of difference. Attention. A little chubby guy off the farm by the name of Warren Sanny went down to the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, and about the third month I was there, I met a guy by the name of Doss Trotman, who for some reason or other decided to put his hooks into me. And when I found out what kind of a man he was, I put my hooks into him. And he became a spiritual father to me. And I couldn't tell you the hundreds of hours that I've spent with him or he spent with me, man to man, person to person. For instance, can I just tell you a little story here? How this worked out and why, what I think it illustrates what I'm talking about. Grew up on the farm in Iowa, moved to California, 16, senior in high school, met a blonde girl, the one you met last night. I was a Christian, she wasn't, went to her church. After some months, one night I knelt beside my bed and received Christ. Meantime, I'd started college. Had a desire to do something for Christ, started a Christian group out there in Modesto Junior College, and in fact, it's still going today, only under another name. And then decided to go to Biola. And while there, I met Dawson Trotman. That's a long story. Well, in the meantime, the church in which I was going had an annual summer Bible camp conference for families for about five or six churches in the San Joaquin Valley in our denomination. And without my knowing it, the pastor got me elected the camp director for the next summer. And I had never been to a conference in my life. And I never forget it because it was called the Northern California Independent Baptist Mount Hermon Bible Conference. That was it. If you ever been out there, it was in Redwood Circle, at Mount Hermon. Well, I'd met Doss Trotman, and I got the pastors to approve him as one of the speakers. Meantime, I had gotten to a Bible study group with Doss and all. We came up as a speaker, and so I was trying to direct this conference. One of the first things he noticed was that I was making announcements, but no one was listening. So he took me off the side. He said, "Sandy, you're making announcements. Do you realize nobody's listening?" I said, "Let me tell you how to make announcements, but how to get people's attention." So he taught me, showed me. Then I had set up some rules. I'd never had them before. We had 11 o'clock curfew. Otherwise, kids had been running around all hours. So one cabin, the kids was out about 12:30 or 1, and I publicly announced that they'd violated the rules, and they'd be on KP the next day. And the whole camp conference blew up in my face. Parents, kids, everybody. So Doss stepped in and got everything calmed down and got the reins back and handed them over to me. Then there were some other headaches. Well, about the third day, he said to me, "Lauren, how would you like to meet me for prayer tomorrow morning?" I said, "Fine, I'd love it." And I said, "What time?" He said, 5 o'clock in the morning. I said, "Pardon me?" He said, 5 o'clock. I said, "All right, where?" He said, "I'll meet you down by the stream." And down there was a little sandbar, and I got there at 5 the next morning. He was already there, and he had a little fire going in the sand. And we spent a couple of hours talking in the Word and in prayer. He said, "Sandy, how would you like to do this tomorrow morning?" I said, "I'd love it. I'd love it." So we did. Well, now, during the preceding year and a half or so, I forget how long, I'd come to know the Lord by myself. Nobody had given me any personal help. But there was a desire to go on with the Lord. Did get a couple buddies in school, and we started this Christian group. And pretty soon we had about 10% of the student body coming. I went to a young people's group, and they'd asked me to begin to speak here or there. But nobody helped me. And down inside, I had some defeats that I just couldn't get victory over. And I wasn't about just to open myself up to anybody. But finally, I thought, if this man loves me enough and is interested in me enough to give me all the time he's given, maybe here's the guy that I can open my heart to. So one night after the evening meeting, he said, "Sandy, why don't we have a little time of prayer down by the stream before we go to bed?" I said, "I'd love it." And I thought, this is my chance. And I said, "Doss, I need some help. And I told him what my problem was, and he helped me. After the conference was over, about a month later, he invited me to come to work with him. He said, Sanny, there'll be no salary, there'll be no promises. We'll share and share alike. You come and live in our home, and you join me in the ministry. And I'd had a couple of scholarships and about three or four other opportunities, and I prayed about it, and I went to live with Doss Trotman. And I was his shadow. Everywhere he went, out there, Sandy was. He'd have an interview with someone. He said, I've got a sidekick, young fellow back here. Do you mind if he sits in and listens? And I'd listen. Well, and Doss Trotman was a hat pin. He just couldn't stand it for anyone to be any less than their best. And this little old chubby, lazy farmer boy probably wouldn't have gotten very far, really, unless God had raised up somebody else. And to a guy like Doss Trotman, who just wouldn't be satisfied with anything but your best. So I know that for one, to get people to work for Christ, it's one by one. I mean, really. You may go around and pick out some, but when it comes to leadership, I think you've got to nail them one by one. That's the slow way, but I don't have any doubt about what it's the powerful way. It's like evangelism. We want to get people to do evangelism, and what's the first thing we always think about? A class. You don't teach people evangelism, how to do evangelism in a class. You just don't do it. You read Kennedy's book, Evangelism Explosion, he'll tell you that. I taught counselor training classes for the Billy Graham team for 7 years, 24 crusades. I don't know how many people, how many on tape, maybe 50 or 100,000. But you don't teach people to do evangelism in classes. We did teach them how to do counseling after a Billy Graham crusade. That doesn't mean that they got out and did evangelism. You've got to use the warm hand principle. That means take them by the warm hand and go out and do it. The people who are self-starters on their own are very few. Isn't that true? You've got to get them by the warm hand. So that's my answer. But I can tell you now that I can give you a lot more illustrations. Can I give you one more? This will stick in your mind. Doss kicked me out of the nest. What was I? 22? Went up to Seattle, Washington, my first navigator responsibility. And I didn't know beans or the bag was open. I wished I could start all over. In fact, my wife and I would like to move to Greeley. We'd like that campus and have a ministry up there. In fact, every place the navigators have an opening, I'd like to move there. Now, I think I could do a better job with collegiates today than ever in my life. I really do. At 50 years of age. I think I'd get next to them easier than I ever could. But anyway, we went up there, and among other things, I was supposed to work with servicemen. Well, Doss called me one day. He said, how's it going? I said, I'm pretty discouraged. Only one guy shows up for my Bible class. Only one serviceman. Well, he said, concentrate on him. So I did. This guy had come. He was a rugged, beetle-browed, lantern-jawed lieutenant in the Army. And he'd come in. I came out to my home for the one-man Bible class, no smile, sit down, kind of beetle-browed. And we'd talk about the Bible and scripture memory and so on, and he'd go and come back the next Monday night. And this went on for a while, and some weeks later he came and he'd smile and sit down and we'd have our class. Progress was being made. Well, pretty soon I found out here was a very faithful man. He began to meet the Lord at 6 o'clock, then 5:30. I remember one night he apologized to me. He said, Laurie, he always called me Laurie. I still don't know why. He said, I know you're talking to me about the importance of balance, but he said, I just don't have enough time with the Lord in the morning. I'm starting to get up at 5 o'clock. I soon learned that he was reviewing 200 or 300 verses a day, and he was one of the most faithful men I'd ever met. Well, when I left the area, he took my place. Well, first of all, after he got out of the service, I asked him to live in my home, which navigators do frequently. Most navigators have 2 or 3 or 4 guys living in their home for some sort of finishing training. So he came to live in our home, and he married the girl who was helping my wife. I left the area, he took over. Then I went with the Billy Graham team, and I needed an assistant, so I got him to come to be my assistant. And a few years later, I went to the New York Crusade, and he was my boss. And this guy I'm talking about is in charge of the counseling and follow-up for the Billy Graham Crusades today, Charlie Riggs. Now, if I'd have been on a personnel committee way back there, we never would have chosen Charlie Riggs for that job. Not this lantern-jawed, beetle-browed guy from the oil fields of Pennsylvania who could hardly speak without stuttering. Weekend before last, we had a couple days together at a ranch over here, and he still calls me Pappy. Well, there's a spiritual son that has long since outgrown his Pappy. But I could just name them down through the years. There they are. I better not use that one. You've got to be careful. I don't want to number any people who want the Lord's blessing to leave, but I really believe that in addition to preaching and in small groups, when you find a faithful man who is able to teach, you zero in on that man. That's the two qualifications, faithful and able. 2 Timothy 2:2. And he's worth all kinds of time. I know Doss did, and I, after him, flew half the continent of Africa just to meet with one man. So, one of the most successful recruiters to get people to work that I know was Dan Pyatt. He was with the Graham team till recently. He used to be in charge of the Navigator work in Europe. And now he's starting a new organization having to do with Bible translation work. And after the day's work in the office is done, setting up a crusade, and after the counseling classes over at night, then he'd begin his appointments with people that he'd spotted during the counseling classes. And they'd go on at 11, 12, 1, and one fellow told me he came out at 2 and there was another man waiting there. But of course, Dan has the goods and people will stay up all night for somebody that can really help them. And one of those guys that told me about this is now in charge of the Navigator work in England. He's a Britisher, Rob Powery Smith, that Dan Pyatt recruited during the Manchester Crusade by looking around and praying that God would lead him to at least one man. And whatever else he did in that city, that he would, God would lead him to one man that he could pour his life into. And so what's happened, that everywhere Dan's gone, you can trace him. There's one, there's one, there's one, there's one. You know, it says that Jesus went about doing good. Somebody said, a lot of us just go about. A lot of us go about preaching or teaching. And so we talk, and then we disappear. One of the great things about Doss Trotman was he could talk to a group, then he could always afterwards, you see him zeroed in on some one person. It's kind of like Jesus walking into Jericho and all the mobs of people, he sees Zacchaeus. So I think you've got to do it one by one. You see what you did? You struck a fire there that I feel pretty keenly about. And I tell you what, I've been preaching this for 20 years. And you know what happens even today? People say, I don't have time for that. And I'm discouraged about it. I really am. I'm discouraged about even saying what I'm just saying. Because I haven't got time for that. I got to do more. I got to handle more people with time than that. Well, I have a little ministry of my own, and I've gone out a lot of time. I'll go out and have, just myself, have Bible study with one couple or with one person. I do this quite a bit. And I happen to share it with somebody. Said, you mean you spend a whole evening with just one couple? Well, can you think of anything any better? Boy, our values get all topsy-turvy. I really do. We get messed up. Priorities. Basics. Well, I've delivered myself of that sermon about 3 times over there, didn't I? Well, we got a few minutes longer here. Yes?
That kind of a principle, when you're working up and building your ministry, certainly you like wait until you get a ministry in France before you administer. But when you come to a church and you've got more administration than you have ministry, what do you do with a class of teenagers that you need a teacher for and you don't have one. You say, well, next year I'll work with one man to man.
Well, I don't know what you do because I have never taken a church. So therefore, I really couldn't say. But maybe somebody who has moved into that situation could say, what have you done? Yes.
Prayed and found a teacher to teach adults, and I'm teaching the teenagers. they're the group that's hardest from later people with the final position.
I can believe that. Listening to my kids talk, I'm sure that's true.
Pastor could take it himself.
I did that and found out that I really cut myself off from many of my adults, and I had to retrace my steps a little bit.
May I toss a theory out to you? As a, you know, we who don't do it have the theory. It's just like the people who are not doing evangelism have all the answers on how to do it. And the guy who's out there beating his head up against it, he's the guy that's looking for answers. Okay, well, I have an answer. I'm not in your position. It seems to me you have to start with where you are. You come in and you slice everything down, well, then you're in trouble to begin with. You can't get anywhere. And it may be completely top-heavy. I think you have to start where you are, even if for no other reason than not to reflect on your predecessor. You have to fall in line. We tell our guys this, even in a similar work. When you go to a new area and take over from someone else, you adopt his program to start with. Make it yours, then you change it, and then you're changing yours and not his. And also, if he has some people that are pretty close to him and they don't respond to you, it makes it a lot easier to bring them along if you make his program yours first. So there's where it takes some patience, it seems to me. Then I think that I would see to it that I got to know personally, as a friend, the key people in my church. And I think that if they're not ready for it, that sometime, somewhere, the best way to win their hearts is to get on your knees with them. It's pretty hard to get on your knees with the man very often and stay surface. This is going to probably the quickest way that I know of winning a person's real heart. Now, I think that this happens all the time. For instance, people will say to me, well, there are navigators in our church that will not teach a Sunday school class. Well, so I think navigators ought to teach a Sunday school class. I think that's something navigators probably ought to do if they know the word like they're supposed to. But I say, why are they called navigators? Why aren't they Andersonites or whatever your name is? Well, one of the reasons is the navigators probably help them at a point of critical need. And I go around, I find people giving credit to the navigators 20 years after we touched their lives, and there have been all kinds of influences since, but the navigators still get the credit. Why? Because we touched them at a critical point. Ministered to them. Now, the key to loyalty, some people say in the navigators, do you have a loyalty? Yes, we do. Some say, well, you must have a pretty tight organization. No, we don't. The only true loyalty is a spiritual loyalty. And if you want to get the loyalty of someone, you have to minister to him spiritually, heart to heart, don't you? Okay, I don't know. You've got to work at it. For instance, we have an area man. He's here. And a navigator moves in from over here. And we have that area man say, well, I can't use him because he's not my man. And I say to myself, we've got a very immature area rep there that can only use people that he himself has raised up. He's got to figure out ways how to win that person. And I don't see how you can go anywhere but what you try to win the friendship and the heart and the allegiance of whoever it is that's in places of leadership, whether you wish it was somebody else or not. You can't bypass them, can you? Then it looks to me like you have to start working at developing some other leadership on this double life thing I'm talking about. Because usually a person who begins to take root and grow That gets noticed. You don't have to advertise them. And they'll end up in places of leadership. But here's something I've wondered. When a church gets big enough, there's only a pastor, and they got a chance to add somebody beyond a secretary, what's the first thing we ask for? Usually it's a youth leader, youth director. And I've been asking around, why is that? That seems to me to be the wrong move. Seems to me to be unscriptural. Seems to me to be poor strategy. And I'd like to be talked out of it. The Bible teaches that the parents are to teach children. If my children are not taught, I cannot blame it on to the Evangelical Free Church, Pastor Alleman's church where we go. I think the Bible fastens that responsibility straight on me. But you know something else I find? You know this. Parents are desperate for help. They're desperate for help, and who's helping them? Who's really helping them to know how to have family devotions? What to do with a kid that may be experimenting with drugs? What to do about this over here? I wondered, we've got all the parents that God intended should be teaching, but what do we do? We're working with the kids, and the people who could work with them 7 days a week are being ignored because nobody's helping them. Why don't we start with a parent director before we start with the youth director? Well, I don't know. That's worth... maybe around the table we'll talk about that a little bit, huh? You say, well, I'm going to put mine with the youth. That's where the future of the church is. Well, if you're going to wait a generation, fine. But you know that I suppose the navigators could quit college ministry and servicemen's ministry and do nothing else but minister to parents. We have a fellow on our staff who gives full time just to counseling staff people and potential staff. The demands upon his time are so tremendous. He's booked up to 73 and he doesn't go outside of our staff much. But he could have conferences. It's a field that's just wild. Take Bill Gothard. Why do they have 2,500, 3,500, 5,000 people coming to hear him on basic youth conflicts? Well, he's hit a market. That's why. He's hit a market. And I've wondered, how many places have I gone to where anybody said, now look, we're going to have a get-together for parents. And over here, how to have quiet time with the preteens, or this age group. Here's this age group. And then the next Saturday we'll come back and we'll talk about what to do about teenagers and dating and the car and all, you know, these various family hassles and so on. But it seems to me like if we got 7 days a week people working on those kids, then we'd be somewhat ahead. It's like I read an illustration once, how to bypass the boss's secretary. Never try. Always win the secretary's friendship, and you'll always have a salesman with the boss. Well, the same with parents. Well, that's just a thought to think about. Sometimes, don't you find that a good way to look at it, it's 180 degrees the opposite direction, and then see what you come up with? Like some of you mentioned, Up the Organization by this guy Townsend. Well, what he does is so stimulating, he just kind of goes the opposite way and comes back at it. He said, well, hey, well, that's quite a... Hadn't thought about that. It's very interesting. Suppose we got a bunch of Sunday school classes. And over here is a reservoir of possible teachers. We try to find out who'd go here. Suppose just for one session, one evening, we looked at it a different way. We looked at Joe here and we said, now I wonder what his greatest gifts are. Does anything exist already to use his gifts? Well, not really. Why don't we create something new then? And start with our resource person instead of our program. But we find a lot of going like this, you know, you can fit into that. We got these squares there. We have one guy that writes our log. He doesn't like organizational charts. He says, I don't want to be a rectangle. He says, I want to be a cloud. I don't even want to close the cloud because I may want to escape. Well, how do you use that kind of a guy? Now we've got a terrific paper there called The Log. And that's the kind of guy it takes to produce it. But you can't fit him into the squares and the rectangles. I mean, that would be another approach, wouldn't it? And who knows that through this person, by helping him, a whole new ministry might grow that would become part of the church program, but we never would have gotten it if we started the program first and the man second. It's just another way of going at it. Well, I guess, is that about enough for tonight? Anybody want to say something before we quit? We've got 1 minute. That you wouldn't want to say you quench the spirit if you don't? Oh, really? Okay, Ron. Thanks a lot.